case, which is Miller versus LaManna. All right, so we have Mr. Sussman here, and you've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right?
Is my adversary not here?
He's on the screen.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So oh, there he is. I'm sorry.
That's Mr. Friedman. I want to just make sure Mr. Friedman can hear us and see us. So, Mr. Friedman?
Yes, Your Honor. I can see and hear you.
Good. And we can see and hear you, too. All right. So with that, then, Mr. Sussman, you've got 7 minutes out of the gate. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Michael Sussman, Sussman & Associates from Goshen. We're here because the district court, under the Lugo case, as I read it, plainly abused its discretion in not reviewing the record which had been submitted on a summary judgment motion, and instead deciding this is a 12B6 matter.
Well, wait one second, because I mean the motion that was filed by your adversary below is very clear. Yeah, it styles itself as a motion for summary judgment, but then it begins and spends a substantial amount of time saying, but actually, we're referring to the pleadings, and the pleadings are inadequate. And although they don't use the word or the number 12C, it seems pretty obvious that that's what's going on, and they can make a 12C at any time, right?
As I understand what the district court did, if one reads the judge's decision, the judge looked, after 3 years of discovery, solely at what was pled.
You can do that 3 years after discovery. You can make a 12C motion and say this pleading does not state a claim.
Well,
now the remedy at that point will typically be.
I was going to say,
go ahead and amend.
Under Lugo, though, it's very clear that the court is concerned that not occur.
No, Lugo is about a 12B1 standing issue, and that can be made at any time.
But
there are, sometimes you limit yourself to the pleadings, and other times you expand the record or the facts to conclude whether or not there is standing.
This motion is as I understand the motion, it was a motion to dismiss. It basically should have been filed as a motion to dismiss. The purpose and the way Judge Roman analyzes it is a motion to dismiss. He looks at the pleading. All that he cites to in his decision, a special appendix, is the pleading. He looks at nothing else.
Right.
So I get that. So in Lugo we say, if you're at the summary judgment phase, you should look at the summary judgment record. And in fact, the stuff that the district court identifies at this stage is something that's subject to further factual development, right? I mean, he's talking about how you don't show the details about the comparators or the personal involvement of the supervisors and so on. And like, that's something that could be the subject of discovery. So like, if there were a deposition sitting around of the comparators or of the supervisors that showed personal involvement or all of the details of comparison, it means that actually, the decision wouldn't make a lot of sense. But at this point, can't we look at the summary judgment record and determine whether there was further factual development that met those requirements?
Look, Your Honor, there's a 90-page statement and counterstatement under Rule 56.1, which elaborates in detail upon the facts which predicate the claim. There are similarly situated individuals identified in 6 paragraphs of the complaint, individuals who are correction officers subject to the same rules. There's evidence presented in the record replete with deviations from policies and practices against Mr. Miller by the agency individuals we sued. There are both deviations which under Arlington Heights are plainly admissible to demonstrate discrimination, as well as this comparator evidence. The district court, respectfully, Judge Sullivan, looked at none of that.
Wait. Point one of this brief.
Which brief now?
The brief of on the motion for summary judgment.
Yeah.
Is all about the complaint fails to state any claim upon which relief may be granted. That's from page 5 all the way to page 10.
I understand.
You don't respond to that.
We do respond
to
it.
No, you don't. You really treat this only as a Rule 56. But the district court goes off on this very point, doesn't it?
Look.
Yes or no?
Yes, but it's inappropriate.
Well,
and it's inappropriate under Lugo because by that time we'd have.
Is it inappropriate under 12C?
Yes, it is inappropriate at that point.
You're saying it would
because,
have been. Wait, just let me finish.
Sure, sorry, go ahead.
You're saying it would have been improper for the defendant in this case to bring a 12C motion.
Absolutely.
Why?
Because at that stage in the litigation, we had advanced well beyond that. But we had had, just let me, I'm trying to answer your question. We had had no opportunity to amend and address.
I agree with all that. The point is, does the rule, is there anything in the rule that would prevent someone from bringing a 12C motion at that stage after discovery?
Well, it effectively makes no sense whether it's whether you're saying the rules of practice, as I understand the rules of practice, is a party who believes that there's a facial insufficiency in a complaint makes a motion with regard to that. The district court then has a proceeding. Normally, our district is a pretrial conference. There's a discussion. There's an opportunity to amend based on whatever the district court has to say, et cetera.
So you're you had never had the chance to amend, because if they had brought a motion to dismiss to say the allegations are insufficient, you would have had a chance to amend and elaborate them. But since there wasn't a motion to dismiss, you just proceeded to discovery, and that's the way you fleshed out the facts, right?
Right. And
that could also be a response to a 12C motion, wouldn't it be? So, like, if they said, we think that the pleadings are insufficient, you would say, well, even if it's not in the complaint, we obviously could include it because we have now have this deposition.
We could include it now.
I have our brief that was submitted to the district court in response, Judge Sullivan, to what you're citing. In our brief, we cite extensively to the complaint to the district court, and we explain that in the complaint, there are comparators, there are clear deviations from protocols and practices indicated, and therefore the rule, whether you fashion it as a Rule 6, 12C, 12B6, whichever you fashion it as, we met the standard. That's the argument that we made. We cite extensively to that record, that is the pleading. So we did answer that, to answer the question directly.
But I've got your brief right in front of me. I don't see any of that. Where are you referring? What page are you referring to?
Okay. You're talking about the brief we submitted below. That's what I hear the court speaking to.
Yes.
I'm looking at page 3 of my brief. It talks about paragraphs 42 and 43 when it speaks about the defendant O'Brien. It speaks about paragraph 48 in the next sentence with regard to Corday. Each of those responses are the paragraphs, Your Honor, in the complaint.
That's just the statement of facts. That's not your argument. Your argument, you don't have anything in here that goes to the sufficiency of the pleading.
But the argument is predicated on what was set forth in the statement of facts. The statement of facts explains, and then the argument takes off from the statements which are presented. I mean, you know, that's what we normally do. We don't necessarily repeat the citation. The citations are in the statement of facts. It's all in there.
I have a hard time reading Lugo as saying anything other than that when you have a situation where the case has already proceeded through discovery, it is kind of crazy to go back and look at the complaint and say, well, you never filed a good complaint in the first place, and so you shouldn't have been entitled to discovery, and so we're going to ignore all the real facts that came out when the discovery was had. That's pretty much what Judge Walker says for the court in Lugo. You didn't have the benefit of Lugo, of course, and neither did Judge Roman when these decisions were made. But as we sit here today, it seems to me very hard to get around the idea that this court has said the sort of sensible thing that, you know, maybe there would have been an alternative. Maybe you could have said, okay, look, Judge, here's why we think the pleading was good enough. But if you think it wasn't good enough, then we can amend to incorporate all these things that we learned in discovery. I suppose that would be another procedural mechanism to get there. But that could have been said in Lugo, too. The fact is that at the time the decision got made, we know more about the facts now. I wouldn't mind hearing a two-sentence, here's the clinching thing that we found in discovery that's different than what was true at the time of the pleadings. But as you said, you've got this huge record, and we're not typically in the business of deciding in the first instance whether what the summary judgment decision should have been when no one made a summary judgment decision.
Look, I agree with that, but I think Judge Sullivan, I don't mean to be offensive, but your statement that Lugo relates to and only relates to standing, or when standing is at issue, as I read Lugo, that's just not accurate. Lugo, you're obviously right, the issue of dispute there were the facts that supported standing. I'm not arguing.
I'm trying to understand why the federal rules allow a motion under 12C to be made as long as it's made before trial. It's clearly after the pleadings. A 12C motion has to be after there's been an answer and after the opportunity to file a 12B6 is over. The rule contemplates that this motion can be made at any time, and the only qualifier is unless the court is concerned that it's going to delay the trial.
Look, if it was so clear to this set of defendants, they don't style it as a 12C motion, as the court acknowledged. They style it as and only as a summary judgment motion. That's what they write. That's what their notice of motion says. Notice of motion doesn't say 12C.
That's true.
Well, does it really matter what the label is? I mean, isn't a possible answer to this question that you can make a 12C motion on the pleadings if there's some legal reason? I mean, this is maybe the distinction between Lugo and the Schwartz case. Is it called Schwartz?
Yeah, Schwartz.
That people talk about? That if there's some legal reason that you could tell in the face of the pleadings that there's just no way that this party could make a claim, maybe that would be appropriate for 12C. But Lugo tells us if you're in the universe in which there is an evidentiary record, it's not appropriate to pretend as if there has been no discovery and just determine whether the facts were adequately alleged in the complaint.
And so then
that would turn whether the reason for the pleadings being adequate is a pure legal question where the facts don't matter, or it is something that's subject to factual development.
And so what
do we have here?
I think you're right, frankly, and all of the cases, there are five cases that they cite, obviously the pre-Lugo cases, all of which say, from Schwartz, that there are situations in which you can. And basically,
Lugo itself says generally it's inappropriate to ignore the evidentiary record. But if it's a thing like Schwartz where, look, no matter what facts you allege, there's no contractual relationship.
That's right.
Here, so, like, you're never going to be able to state a claim.
That's exactly right.
Then it does make sense to ignore the factual record.
And
so
all
it
of those
depends on whether that affects the claim, right?
And every one of the cases cited pre-Lugo for that proposition involves the absence of a record which has been developed and a focus on a legal conclusion. Every one of the cases they cite. We cite, Your Honor, this goes to the point you made, the post-Lugo cases where it goes well beyond standing. There are three cases we found in the Southern District which apply Lugo. They apply Lugo to situations just like this, and they say you can't convert. You cannot convert. It's called reverse conversion. You can't do that. That's what this judge essentially did. He didn't rely on a legal principle of the sort that Judge Menasche is referring to. He relies, Judge Lynch, I want to get back to your question and then I'll shut up. But you asked about the smoking gun. Well, one area where you have a smoking gun relates to this whole issue of the gentleman isn't allowed to work a second job. Okay, now he knows he's not allowed to work a second job, but the rationale for it's never stated until we get to discovery. And then we have the attendance officer from the facility, Corday, who says Miller's not a problem. It's what he testified to under oath. Yet the two people in Albany.
Yeah, but he also says I didn't really know about his particular record, right?
No, he says he didn't deal with his record because he wasn't a problem. He was the person who would deal with that record.
So the details of him didn't come to his attention, but he wasn't really saying I know.
But this is essentially a garden variety employment discrimination case where we have these summary judgment issues all the time.
You're right.
They are often very close questions. The district court makes a ruling. We sometimes overturn that ruling and often accept that ruling.
Right.
Because there's a standard that's applied. We generally don't do that. If the district court applied the wrong standard, we don't then go and make our own decision ab initio on the summary judgment. But this is distinctly not a case where there is some supervening legal issue. It's a case where you made certain allegations. If that were going to be decided on the pleadings, we would have another kind of close question about whether what you've alleged is enough to plausibly, under Twombly, as ambiguous and difficult as that decision often is, to plausibly raise an inference of discrimination as a prima facie case. Then there's another type of decision that gets made when you've got a fleshed-out record. And I do think the labels do matter, because if we're going to tax you with not treating this as a 12C motion and responding to it, then don't we have to kind of tax the other side for not labeling it a 12C motion? You respond to what's before you. You responded to a summary judgment motion the way one responds to a summary judgment motion.
Look, you know,
you didn't have the benefit of Lugo at the time, but now you do, saying that you did the right thing.
But the point...
And the district court did the wrong thing by not looking at the actual evidentiary record that was made.
Right. Judge Menasche, just one point. You raised a question about your sort of ab initio deciding a summary judgment motion. And I think the precedent that I've found in the circuit is in situations like this, and they're frankly rare. This is not a standard practice, to go back again to what Judge Sullivan is saying about Rule 12.6. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's not a standard practice. I've been doing these cases for 40 years, and I've never seen a 12C at the end of discovery in an employment discrimination case. I've seen summary judgment motions made, as Judge Lynch is talking about, all the time, and here we responded to it with diligence, dealing with the facts that they alleged. The other part of it is, just to be clear, when you talk about 12C, and they spend time on that. They spend time on a summary judgment motion setting forth a statement under Rule 56.1 to which we responded. That well transcends what was in the pleadings. So what is the point? How is justice served by saying to a litigant who's litigated for 3 years all of that, we're going to now revert to a pleading which was never challenged under 12b-6, and we're going to take a look at the pleading and ignore all the evidence that's been developed? It's illogical.
Well, it seems to me that's a quibble with the rule, but the solution is an easy one. I mean, it seems to me you respond to the argument made in their brief, which is that that the complaint fails to state a claim. Or you say, we want to amend, and that's not a hard thing to do, and the amending, the rule for amendments is very, very forgiving.
But
you didn't engage in the argument.
But at that point, there is no, first of all, as Judge Lynch said, I didn't really, I have in my brief exactly the point before Lugo, that this is not an appropriate mechanism at this point in time to make the arguments you're making. You've spent 3 years litigating a case and developing a full record. Let's deal with the full record. I make that argument. I also cite...
No, you make that argument. You don't challenge the insufficiency of the pleading.
I do challenge that because I lay out in my statement of facts all the sufficiency.
Where do you make an argument?
I didn't make the argument because I was beyond that point. That's the whole point.
I'm just saying you didn't.
Thank you.
You made the argument that was made in Lugo and prevailed
exactly.
In Lugo.
All right, we'll now hear from Mr. Friedman.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Josh Friedman on behalf of LaMarcia Franco Law. I represent the appellee's defendants. May it please the court. The first thing that I just want to raise, which Your Honors picked up on, is the idea of labels mattering. And I want to make clear that in Lugo, the court was very clear that Lugo was decided with reference to the issue of standing. And the issue of standing, which...
The court was not very clear that it was just about standing, right? The court says it's appropriate to evaluate the claims based on the stage of litigation that we're at, and it's generally inappropriate at the summary judgment phase to ignore the summary judgment record, right? What about that is limited to the issue of standing? Just like you could flesh out allegations that establish standing, you could flesh out allegations that state a claim, couldn't you?
That's fair, Your Honor, but what I'm referring to is the paragraph in the bill that states this: the district court erred in resolving the question of standing, which was raised at the summary judgment stage under the standards applicable to a Rule 12 motion to dismiss on the pleadings. And I also point out that the cases that Lugo relied upon also pertain, Jones in particular from the Ninth Circuit, also pertain to standing. So the only authority that we have are cases that were concerned with the issue of standing.
All right, so if we think it's inappropriate when you're at the summary judgment phase to make a determination on standing based only on the factual allegations and to ignore the summary judgment record, why would it not be inappropriate to determine the factual sufficiency of a complaint based only on the complaint while ignoring the summary judgment record? What's the difference?
Well, I would assert that it is appropriate at the summary judgment stage to make a determination that the complaint fails to state a cause of action. And one of the chief differences is the fact that the federal rules actually spell out that you are permitted to make to raise a defense based upon failure to state a cause of action as late as trial. So we actually did it earlier than that. In fact, we raised it, the defense.
But you could do that also. You could do that also for standing, right?
Well, with standing, another functional difference between standing and failure to state a cause of action is with standing, it's actually incumbent upon the court to independently determine that they're standing, regardless of whether there's a motion or not. So it's the court's obligation under Rule 12H that if the court at any point in time determines that there's not subject matter jurisdiction, that it then must dismiss the action. So that's another difference between standing and failure to state a cause of action, which, you know, it would make sense for the court to have to examine the summary judgment record with respect to standing if you've got one party saying, hey, if you look at this, you'll see that there is or there is not standing. It would make sense for them to have to look at it in that case.
Yeah, but why, why doesn't it equally make sense in this situation? After all, just as certain issues, legal issues, if there was some legal flaw in the complaint that no one on the defense side discovered or that maybe is revealed by subsequent case law, you can make your motion to dismiss on the pleadings at any point. But if you're talking about the facts, the same as you are in the standing case, that have been developed, well, then Rule 15C comes into play, right? Even during trial, if there are new facts, the complaint can be deemed amended to take account of the evidence that was in the record at trial. So why on earth doesn't it make sense? I mean, you may have a right. The whole point of Twombly, the whole point of having a fairly tough 12B6 standard is to save defendants the trouble of going through discovery. Once they've already gone through discovery and it turns out, perhaps, we don't know because no one ever actually assessed the summary judgment record, if it turns out that the evidence developed in discovery shows that the plaintiff really does have a case that ought to be tried, why on earth shouldn't the court be required to look at that?
Well, Judge, I think the reason is because it's not the court's obligation or burden to state the plaintiff's case for
them. No, the plaintiff stated, the plaintiff stated the case. The plaintiff explained to the district court, I don't know how persuasively, the plaintiff explained to the district court, here's why the defendant is not entitled to summary judgment and we should have a trial. And no one's asking the district court to sort of make up arguments for the plaintiff. The plaintiff made up the arguments and presented them to the district court. And the district court declined to consider them on the theory that we never should have wasted all that time in discovery because there was a defect in the complaint, which is a factual defect, presumably, not sufficiently plausible allegations that could be cured now in light of the evidence that's been developed. So why don't we just cut to the chase, and this is exactly what Lugo says as I read it, cut to the chase, decide the case based on the record that's now been developed. What is the problem with that?
Well, Judge, I think there's perhaps not a problem with that if you're working with a complaint that's very, it may be missing minimal allegations, or it's abundantly clear what the allegations for the most part are and what the claims sought to be asserted are. However, if you have a complaint that is grossly inadequate, regardless of the stage.
It was so grossly inadequate, it could have been a motion right at the beginning. Now, maybe you haven't waived the right to make the motion. That's not really so much a thing. But I'm just having a little trouble understanding. We have a standard for what happens at the pleading stage before there's a record. And the point of being tough on plaintiffs at that stage is so that defendants don't have to go through a lot of trouble. If the defendant says, we don't care, we'll go through the trouble. We'll have the discovery. We're so confident that we're going to have great evidence that at the summary judgment stage we'll knock it out. And we have that process. We spend years doing that, wasting everybody's time and money, except that by hypothesis, the plaintiff actually discovers facts that would satisfy the Twombly standard and more, that would satisfy the summary judgment standard. What justifies saying, too bad, Mr. Sussman, you didn't respond to this by saying, okay, now I'm going to amend my complaint. I amend my complaint to include all the facts that I included in my summary judgment Rule 56 statement. Who is benefited by making that the rule?
Judge, I think if you look at Lugo, one of the court's primary concerns, it seems, in Lugo is the efficient administration of justice. And I think we have to look at what would the practical effect of that rule be. If we were to say, district court, you now have to go to the summary judgment record and sort of fill in the gaps in the complaint to find...
But the district court does not need to fill in the gaps in the complaint. If there had been a motion to dismiss at the 12B6 phase, then the plaintiff would have the benefit of the decision about what's the problem with the complaint and could amend the complaint. But if the defendant is not trying to dismiss it as inadequate, then the plaintiff develops facts by engaging in discovery. Doesn't it seem a lot more inefficient if after you're developing an evidentiary record to then obsess over whether the facts are articulated precisely enough in the complaint? Like, that's like going back in time in the litigation. Shouldn't we be focused on what the summary judgment record says?
I think whether or not the defendants in this case took the most efficient route certainly can be debatable, but I think when we look at the rule, it's clear that what the defendants did was permitted.
Let's go to the rule. I mean, the rule says, after the pleadings are closed, but early enough not to delay trial. It doesn't say, but before discovery is started or before discovery is completed. It just says, early enough not to delay trial, a party may move for judgment on the pleadings, right?
Correct.
And, and 12H also contemplates that there will be opportunities to bring a challenge to the pleadings before the trial, even during the trial, actually.
That's right, Your Honor.
So I guess my question for you is simply, why didn't you not identify what you were doing? Why didn't you call it a 12C? Why didn't the district court do the same?
Again, whether or not that may have been a strategic error or not, I think...
Are you saying it was a strategic decision not to call it that?
Well, at the time, the binding authority that we were looking at was Schwartz, which Schwartz says...
Why was the defining authority not Rule 12C?
With respect to what motion, what I'm referring to is what motion needed to be brought in order to assert that argument. It was our belief that bringing a motion for summary judgment would subsume an argument that the pleading itself was insufficient on its face. And in fact, that's how the district court viewed it. I mean, in effect, the district court treated it exactly as a...
So you thought that you could grant summary judgment on the basis of the pleadings being inadequate, was your position?
Correct.
I can ask you this question. So in light of Lugo, now that we have Lugo, if at the summary judgment phase, a defendant brings a motion under 12C and says, well, we've engaged in 3 years of discovery and we have a summary judgment record, but on the face of the pleadings, we don't think that the plaintiffs adequately allege injury causation and redressability, so there's no standing. Could the district court grant a 12C motion at that stage on the basis of lack of standing, given the factual allegations of the complaint?
A 12C motion for lack of standing, which is subject matter jurisdiction, 12B1?
Yeah, well, the pleadings have to allege injury causation and redressability. So I guess, so what's the answer to that question?
I would say that the answer to that question is that if you're arguing that that dismissal is warranted based upon standing, it wouldn't be a motion for judgment on the pleadings. It would be a motion to dismiss based upon subject matter lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
And so if the argument that there's a lack of subject matter jurisdiction is that the allegations of the complaint don't show injury, causation, or redressability, what does the district court do?
Well, it's, again, it's the district court's independent obligation, even irrespective of whether or not there's a motion, to analyze whether standing, whether subject matter jurisdiction and standing.
And independent of whether it's in the pleadings, right? A district court at that point is free to consider facts outside the pleadings to determine whether there's subject matter jurisdiction.
That's
correct?
Right. Yes.
Right, but, you know, Judge Walker, if I recollect correctly, I don't have it right in front of me, cites Rule 1 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, that all of these rules are to be interpreted in order to deal with the speedy, efficient, and just resolution of the cases. It seems to me that when we get to the summary judgment stage, and this is exactly what happened in Lugo, when we get to the summary judgment stage, either Mr. Sussman has a case that withstands summary judgment. In that case, it would certainly be unjust to throw him out of court. It would also not be particularly efficient to go through the process of saying what you have to do now is we make a Rule 12C motion, you then say, okay, I see there are certain deficiencies in the complaint that are addressed. I ask for leave to amend my complaint to incorporate all the facts that we learned in discovery. When those facts are there, then the judge decides a renewed motion on the pleadings. And if there is enough to satisfy the Twombly standard, then there has to be another motion for summary judgment to say that even though that was enough to get you past the a plausible thing, it's still not enough that a reasonable jury could make that decision, and then the judge decides that motion. And that's the procedure that you are advocating, it seems to me, rather than cutting to the chase, deciding the case on the summary judgment record, just the way Judge Walker said in Lugo, we're supposed to do it, because that will be the most efficient and just thing. If you win, because the plaintiff still doesn't really have enough, despite the bluster, to satisfy the Celotex standard, the case is over, and we don't have to go through all this rigmarole with changing the pleadings. If you lose, then the case proceeds to trial because that's the just result. And that's the most efficient result because that's what would have happened if the facts that are there in the summary judgment record, if pleaded, would justify getting you past the 12B6/12C standard. So I'm just having, you know, that seems to me to be so straightforward and so straightforward an application of Lugo that I don't understand how is the world better if we adopt your rule?
Well, Judge, I guess one thing I respectfully take issue with is the idea that there would have to be multiple motions. The way that we put the motion together was essentially that the first part of the motion was that the complaint on its face was insufficient to state a claim, and if the court felt otherwise, that based on the summary judgment record, we feel that there are no tribal issues of fact. So it was one motion in the court.
Well, yeah, but the first thing is decided and the court says what you think the court should have said, or what the court did say, dismissed, then why isn't the next move, well, then can I amend my complaint? Unless you're taking the position that under Twombly, because the plaintiff never should have gotten this discovery, the plaintiff is precluded from citing the evidence that came up? Is that the position?
No, I think what the plaintiff's remedy here was to, in response to our motion, which very plainly and clearly put them on notice that we were arguing the facial sufficiency of the amended complaint, in response to that, their remedy was a cross motion for leave to amend the complaint. And I'd also like to point out that the idea that a motion to dismiss at the pleading stage is a very, always a very efficient, you know, one and done motion process is I think not entirely accurate, particularly in cases such as this where you've got multiple defendants. Some may be dismissed, some may not be dismissed. And oftentimes what ends up happening in cases such as this are a motion to dismiss is made,
Indeed so, it's granted, then there's a motion to amend the complaint, and that happens, and sometimes there are several rounds of this. I'm not suggesting that that is always a model of simplicity and efficiency, but it does protect the defendant against having to go through years of discovery if at the end of that chain of amendments, the ruling is still he hasn't got enough. But once you've gone through the process of discovery, I'm not sure what's being protected anymore. Unless you're saying that you are entitled now retroactively to cancel the discovery, so that if it is the case that the discovery record developed enough to not only, that not only could the plaintiff state a claim, but the plaintiff can state a claim which is backed up by enough evidence to survive the summary judgment standard, right? That's what's being contended here. And but are you saying he can't do that at all? Because we should go back and just pretend the discovery never happened? He has to amend his complaint based on things he knew before?
You're not saying that, are you?
I guess I'm not really understanding the question. Forgive me, Judge.
Let me try and clarify it. What I'm saying is, at this stage of the case, would the plaintiff be entitled, if the court is correct that the underlying complaint was not good enough, is the plaintiff entitled to amend his complaint based on, in part, what was learned in the discovery phase?
I think if the plaintiff had made a cross motion for leave to amend their complaint, then, and the court granted that motion, then absolutely they would be entitled to amend the complaint at this stage.
And then what would follow from that is, at least if it is the case, as Mr. Sussman contended in his response to your motion, that there is enough evidence now to defeat summary judgment and proceed to trial, would it not follow a fortiori that there is enough evidence that if it was all loaded into an amended complaint would survive a Rule 12b6 or Rule 12c motion?
Well, I suppose that presupposes that there is enough evidence to do that.
Of course it does. But that's what he'd like the district court to decide, right? I mean, and by the way, if it's up to us to decide that, putting aside the normal practice and putting aside the fact that we don't normally do this in the first instance, both sides tell us, not our backup argument in your case is absolutely this fails summary judgment, or for that matter in his case, that it absolutely succeeds. You both say, we're not going to give you the whole story on summary judgment. We're just going to hit the highlights. And you, Court of Appeals, should now decide on the basis of like 5 pages of briefing on each side whether that 90-page Rule 56 statement was sufficient or not. I mean, that's nuts, it seems to me.
Is you're asking him to agree if that's nuts?
No, I guess not. Sorry. I know you can't agree if that's nuts. That's a rhetorical question.
All right. Well, let's hear from Mr. Sussman for 3 minutes of rebuttal.
All right. I'll try to keep it less than that. First of all, this was not viewed by the district court as a 12C motion. If you look at the special appendix at page 5, the court thus begins by analyzing plaintiff's fact for sufficiency under Rule 12b6.
Right, that's the standard for 12c, right?
No. But the judge never mentions 12c. The judge only mentions 12b6.
Well, what else could it be, I guess, is the question, right? I mean, it's after the pleadings. and it's before trial.
But the standard in our circuit, as far as I know, again, the court may have different frame of reference, is that if a party has a 12B6 motion, for all the reasons set forth in Lugo and 1,000 other cases, they make the 12B6 motion before they answer.
No, they have to do it before they answer.
But, right? But that's the point. So that's not what's being done here. No one had the understanding. I didn't have the understanding it was a 12C motion. I had the understanding.
So how would the standard for a 12C motion differ from the 12B6 standard?
It's not the question of whether the standard differs. The question of procedurally, can you bring a 12B6 motion after you've completed all the discovery,
all right,
or do you waive it?
Let's say they labeled it 12C and it was otherwise exactly the same. What should the district court have done?
The district court should have reviewed the summary judgment record. That's what the district court should have done. It's a Rule 56 motion. 3 years of discovery are there.
If this is a hypothetical,
if
they had clearly labeled it a 12C, if the defendants had, and if the judge had said, "Yeah, I'm going to 12C," you're saying still the judge would have had to proceed as a 56.
As I read, and we had this conversation earlier, I want to, from my point of view, repeat it. As I understand Lugo and what Lugo is saying and the logic of Lugo, a defendant party, particularly governmental actors, and here we have governmental actors who are so concerned about qualified immunity, they never make a qualified immunity claim. They don't try to truncate the litigation, which we have all the time from litigators like this. They go forward with 3 years of litigation.
I think your position is...
My position is he should have decided...
To the extent that the argument is the complaint is inadequate because of a lack of factual allegations, the district court should take into account the summary judgment record. To the extent that it's just a legal conclusion that doesn't depend on the factual development, then you could grant a motion just by looking only at the pleadings.
As long as we're not wasting that record, because that record should inform the decision, and that's what Lugo says with regard to the standing analysis, but it's not limited to that. It makes clear, and Your Honor said this yourself, as I heard you, that the purpose of Lugo was to make a more general rule, which has logic to it and is consonant with the practice that, as far as I know, goes on all the time in our district courts.
This is
not that practice.
Whatever the judge said in his opinion, the notice of motion, no, it does not label it as a 12C. It doesn't label it as a 12B1.
Or 12B6.
This is a motion for summary judgment for each of the defendants.
That's what
it says on JA56.
And they submitted, and
well,
Judge Lynch,
not,
well,
12B1,
sorry,
I'm confused.
12B6. They submitted.
It's not 12B6, it's not 12C. It doesn't say anything about either of them.
No.
It says it's a motion for summary judgment.
And they submitted in support of their motion, counsel argues it's made in the alternative. I don't believe at that stage of the litigation that has any logic to it. We've developed the record. The record should have been considered, and the matter should be remanded. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both. We will reserve decision.